So we just do the word of the Buddha class. Don't know what we do this for. It's especially part of the training for all the novices and anagarikas. So every 2 years I read out from the word of the Buddha, and on the other year, every 2 years, read out the first 10 suttas from the Majjhima Nikaya. And the reason why I do that is so that at least I know that everyone who's trained to become monks in this monastery, they have to go through that 2 year training, I know they've at least know what the Buddha taught. Because sometimes you read books or you listen to teachers such as me, and sometimes that, you know, we sort of add a little bit here, subtract a little bit there. And even though it's based on the word of the Buddha, it's sometimes very important to know exactly what the Buddha taught. So that's why we're going through this particular book, The Word of the Buddha, which was an anthology made by Venerable Jnana Taloka many years ago. And it's a pretty good one, and it's just a nice little textbook which we can use. So because it's the Word of the Buddha, it gives a very accurate description of the basic teachings of the Buddha. Of course, that sometimes there's other teachings which came after the life of the Buddha. And I'm not just saying this because I'm a Theravada monk. It's very clear when you use reason and evidence that you can put a date on many of the teachings which came after the life of the Buddha. The usual way of doing that is using the same sort of analysis which was developed by linguists who wanted to find out, you know, the age of passages in the Christian Bible. And they developed a methodology, which is basically using evidence of vocabulary, a sentence structure, which changes from time to time. You know that if you just read some Shakespeare and then you read Harry Potter, you realize that there's a lot of differences in the language, in the vocabulary, and you'll be very clear that one was written much later than the other. I think no one would ever be able to think that Harry Potter was written by William Shakespeare. The language is different, the vocabulary is different. And the same type of analysis has been used on all of these things which are supposed to be the Buddha's teaching, and it can be very clear that what's the original teaching of the Buddha and what came later. And here, because it's called the Word of the Buddha, it's like the original teaching of the Buddha. So we're going to the source. So at least you know what the Buddha taught. And that's the whole idea of this exercise. The basic teachings of the Buddha. And then what comes afterwards, it doesn't mean it's wrong. You can actually read all the stuff which came afterwards. But at least you can read it in the context of what was original to the time of the Buddha. And the way this is put is a very useful scheme of four noble truths, basic teaching of the Buddha, you know, the truth of suffering, the origin of suffering, the end of suffering, and the path leading to the end of suffering. And with the path, we get the whole Eightfold Path. And the book finishes off with the gradual training, and it's a very beautiful way of talking about basic Buddhism, which is common to all streams of Buddhism, basic Buddhism. That's why I wanted people who train here at least to know what the Buddha taught, and then they could add whatever they like to it afterwards, but at least they've got the foundation. Any questions to that before we begin? Okay, so here we go. I'm going to start on page one. So not forget about the introduction. So the Word of the Buddha, and hopefully, that Dania, did you, how far did you photocopy to? Oh, that's to page 10. Okay, oh, good. Great. Okay, so you did the whole of the First Noble Truth.
Yes.
Oh, excellent. Okay, because I think more books may be coming in a couple of weeks' time, so please keep these. So here we go. And I usually do the Namo Tassa before we begin.
Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa Buddhang dhammang sanghang namassami.
This is the word of the Buddha by Venerable Jnanatiloka, or the Four Noble Truths. Thus it has been said by the Buddha, the Enlightened One, it is through not understanding, not realizing four things that I, disciples as well as you, had to wander so long through this round of rebirths. Now what are these four things? Now of course that one paragraph has a huge amount of information in it. First of all, the round of rebirths. Sometimes people say, oh, the Buddha never taught rebirth. Or it was only just added because that's how they viewed things in the time of the Buddha. And it's not essential to the teachings of the Buddha. So you see, it's right here in the very beginning. So rebirth or reincarnation, whichever you wish to call it, is very central to Buddhism. And number two, this saying, I think I always remember this, the reason why you get reborn, that you wander so long through this round of rebirths, is through not understanding, not realizing these Four Noble Truths. That's the cause for getting reborn. So, how many of you understand the Four Noble Truths? Very good. Because if you did, you'd be saying, I'm enlightened. I'm not going to get reborn again. So what is it you don't understand? Look, let's listen to them. The Four Noble Truths. The Noble Truth of Suffering, of Dukkha. The Noble Truth of the Origin of Suffering, Dukkha Samudaya. The Noble Truth of the Extinction of Suffering, Dukkha Nirodha. And the Noble Truth of the Path that leads to the Extinction of Suffering. So I always focus on that. What is it you don't understand of those things? There must be something there in one of those Four Noble Truths. Otherwise, you'd be able to put your hand up and say, this is my last birth, I'm not going to get reborn again. So these are important things. The Buddha's actually saying, if you understand these Four Noble Truths, that's it. Finished. If you don't, it means you're still Putujana. This is repeated in the next paragraph. As long as the absolutely true knowledge and insight as regards these Four Noble Truths, the absolutely true and full knowledge, I would say, was not quite clear, fully clear, that's sui sudang, was not fully clear in me, so long was I not sure that I had won that supreme enlightenment which is unsurpassed in all the world, with its heavenly beings, its maras and gods amongst all the hosts of ascetics, priests, kings and men. I changed a few things there. The heavenly beings, that's the devas, the maras and brahmas. You all know what the maras are. Amongst all the hosts of ascetics and priests, that's the samana brahmana. And I think it was Maurice Walsh made a sort of very good point. The deva manusa, the kings and the royalty, they always considered actually one of their epithets was devas. Because devas was already mentioned before, he made a very important point. This is like the royalty of men and human beings. Of course, it could be that heavenly beings and men, because there's no mention of women there, it could be that heavenly beings was referring to women. Just stirring things up a bit there. But no, it means heavenly beings and humans. But as soon as the absolutely true knowledge and insights as regard these Four Noble Truths have become perfectly clear in me, there arose in me the assurance that I'd won that supreme enlightenment unsurpassed. So it's when he was absolutely sure, perfectly clear in me, the Four Noble Truths, then he knew the rebirth had been ended. And I discovered that profound truth, so difficult to perceive, so difficult to understand. Peaceful, the word is santo, and sublime, which is not to be gained by mere reasoning, and is visible only to the wise. So that's one of the reasons why philosophers, they just haven't got much of a clue. It's not just by reasoning. And of course we find out how it's obtained. How is it obtained then if it's not by mere reasoning? Any ideas? No. How is it seen? He said it's difficult to understand. It can't be understood by mere reasoning. So how do you understand it? No. 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 What do you have to do? Eightfold path. Yes. It's tricky, but now this is, get this in your head. This is the way. This is how it's done. Eightfold path. Eightfold path. Eightfold path. And you've got to say this because sometimes people say, "Yeah, insight." Sometimes jhanas. No, it has to be the whole eightfold path.
So it has to be the teachings of,
yeah, it has to be. That's part of it. Samadhi, the first factor, as we find out later on. But it's how it's understood, because too often that people always say like insight or even jhana or you know, whatever. But you have to say the eightfold path, that is the path, that is the way. When we try and sort of take parts of this off and parts of it off, then we don't get anywhere. So the eightfold path is the way. That's very good to keep that in your head. Yes?
Did the previous Buddha and the Tathagata on the truth, did they also frame it in the eightfold path?
Yep. There was that story of saying, did the previous Buddhas frame it in the eightfold path? There's that wonderful story of the ancient city and the lost path of the ancient city. What was that lost path? The eightfold path. That's actually one of the sayings of the Buddha. So it's a lost city. In other words, Nirvana has existed before, where it's always there in the sense of cessation. But it's said, you know, taught by, say, the previous Buddha, but it's, the path has been overgrown, like an old path through the jungle. And now it's reopened. And what is that path? The eightfold path. So eightfold path, eightfold path. That is the path, that is the way, that's what you've got to practice. Not jhana, not insight, not effort, not right view, not just your precepts, the whole thing. Otherwise it doesn't work. And that profound truth, it's difficult to perceive, difficult to understand, but it's also peaceful and sublime. That's another important word, because how do we know something is truthful? This is one of its characteristics. It always gives rise to peace, to calm, to stillness. So if you've got some insight and it makes life even more troublesome for you, it can't be insight. Truth, one of its main characteristics, has to be giving rise to peace. Okay, now this world, however, is delights in alaya. Given to pleasure, that's not really good. It delights in alaya, is enchanted with alaya. And who knows what alaya means? Maybe an alaya knows what alaya means. So what does alaya mean? An alaya. Yes, like a resting place. And that's the way the word is used, because we know that hima alaya, the Himalayas. Hima means snow, and alaya means a resting place of snow. And there's another state in the northeast of India called Meghalaya. Mega means clouds. And it's the resting place of the clouds. So this is actually where things rest, where they roost, where they settle and grow. And this is a nice little way of understanding this. This world, however, delights in settling into things, into allowing things to settle and grow. A good example of that, I don't know how long you've been in this monastery, but what about your rooms now? Have you already really settled into it? Your little nest and home? You see, this is our nature, to sort of make these little nests. Not only that, but there's some of the metaphysical nests where we sort of stick to, where the snow sticks to the mountains. So alaya is like to sticking to things. We are given to sticking to things, delighting in sticking to things, enchanting with sticking to things. Truly, such beings will hardly understand the law of conditionality dependent origination. We'll come to that later on. Incomprehensible to them will also be the end of all formations. That doesn't say very much. It is the calming, the samatuing of all sankharas. And of course, as we'll find out shortly, one of the most important of those sankharas is will. Incomprehensible to them will be the calming to disappearing of the will of Chaitanya. That's actually a decent translation of that term. And that's why I often sort of start to say, you know, let go of the will disappears and vanishes. And that does scare the pants off many people. Because it's incomprehensible. How can that happen? The forsaking of every substratum of rebirth, this is more like causes of rebirth, and a fading away of craving, detachment, extinction, nirvana. It's nice to word the words extinction for Niroda. It shows that these are not separate things. It's almost what happens. Craving stops. Actually, the detachment, we argue, is more like the fading away. Niroda, things actually cease. They stop. This is things actually really extinguishing, like a flame extinguishes it. Nirodas in nirvanas. Stopping, emptiness, gone, poof. Incomprehensible to them will be these things. Incomprehensible will be that nirvana is when everything stops with nothing left. I often mention that because even monks, let alone sort of philosophers, we all posit the one thing, that in nirvana there is something left, even just a small amount of me. You've worked so hard. So surely you should be able to enjoy at least something in nirvana. And when monks like me come along and say, nirvana, everything's gone, finished, poof, disappeared. They think, no, 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 I don't want to do that. What am I doing that for? I worked so hard, I want to enjoy nirvana once I get there. Work so hard for it. But, sorry mates. Fading away, craving. Detachment is really fading away. Extinction. Nirvana, gone, poof, disappeared. You shouldn't know that extinction. If everything is extinction, what can be left? Yet there are beings whose eyes are only a little covered with dust. They will understand the truth. So sometimes the Buddha says these things again and again. After a while you get it. And you realize there's nothing here anyway, so what's wrong with everything disappearing? Any questions? Ajahn Chah always used to say when we first got to his monastery, have you come here to die? And that's what he meant. Not just your body to die, but your will to die and your consciousness to die. To stop, to disappear, with nothing left. So this is the big dying. Are you ready for that? Okay, oh, you've got a question?
I never know how we can avoid in the future.
Yeah?
And I thought that, well, I can't speak for anyone else, but you know, without really any idea what the father is, but should one sort of understand that there's no life on it, if I die through the present moment?
Yeah, because that's the only way out of samsara in the present moment. In the present moment, there's nothing there. Because all of your hopes and dreams, all of your memories, most of what you think you are, is all about past and future. In the present moment, much of you vanishes. Who do you think you are? Who do you think you're going to be? That's 99.999999% of you. If you look in the present moment, you haven't got a clue what you are. Nothing to define you by. The same in the present moment. There's nothing to do. Remember, all craving is about where you want to be in the future. All anger is what happened to you in the past. So in the present moment, where can there be any craving? Where can there be any anger or guilt? So things start to disappear when you stay right here. they vanish and go. You find when you wait in the moment vanishes. The great disappearing. But you are some beings, only a little covered with dust. You will understand how to vanish. So, here we go in more detail. That's only just the introduction, just the trailer of what's going to happen next. Now we come to the first part of the movie. The first truth, the noble truth of suffering, of dukkha. What now is a noble truth of suffering? And I say suffering, and it is suffering. It's a decent translation for a change. Not, what is Tamisra called it? Stress. It's not stress, it's suffering. It hurts. What now is suffering? Birth is suffering. Is it? Well, look, I've seen people get so happy when the birth of their kid. They say it's the most, they're sometimes there when their child is born, and they even bring it out of their womb. You know, and they say it's the most wonderful. This is creation happening right in front of them, another being. Birth is one of the most amazing things in the whole world. Is that right?
Not the baby,
no, they haven't got a terrible time. Get spanked as soon as they come out. They haven't done anything yet.
Death is pretty amazing.
Death has been amazing. But you ask a person who's doing it and they sort of want to get it over as soon as possible.
They can't feel
those two bones. Yep. Birth is suffering. Decay is suffering. It's really old age is suffering. And I know that, especially today. I woke up this morning, I was 1 year older than I was when I went to bed last night. Old age is suffering. Because you know what happens when you... Actually, birthdays are suffering as well, not birth. Birthdays are much suffering. And death is suffering. Sorrow, lamentation, pain, grief and despair are suffering. Now we get to the interesting part. Not to get what one wants is suffering. And actually sometimes they say the separation separation from what you want and being with what you don't want is suffering. They sometimes extend that. And that's the one which I like the best, because what it says, not to get what one desires is suffering. But what about getting what you want? Is that suffering? And of course it is suffering. That's what we were talking about the other day. It was Oscar Wilde who said, there's only two types of suffering in this world. The first is not getting what you want. And the second is getting what you want. Because you find as soon as you get what you want, it's not quite what you expected. It always lets you down. It's not what was advertised when you bought it. So this is what happens when you get what you want. It's still suffering. The most important part is the wanting in the first place. It's what I keep saying, there's a separation from where you are and where you want to be. That is suffering. I don't want to be here, I want to be somewhere else. That's suffering. So that's why craving is suffering. In short, the five groups of existence, the khandhas, are suffering. We'll come into that in a few moments. But now we have the explanation, because when the Buddha was teaching, he realized that people would sometimes misinterpret his meaning and give it all sorts of other explanations which he didn't mean. So he actually defined things. What now is birth? Sometimes people say birth is just you're born every moment. Birth is the rising of this next moment, which is fine, but it's not what the Buddha said. What the Buddha said, birth. The birth of beings belonging to this or that order of beings. They're being born, their conception is springing into existence. The manifestation of the groups of existence, the khandhas, the arising of sense activity. This is called birth. That same explanation is expanded in, say, like the Mahanidana Sutta, where the birth of beings belong to this or that order of beings. For example, birds into the state of being birds. Four-legged animals into the state of four-legged animals. Humans into the state of humans. Creepy crawlies into the state of creepy crawlies. So it's very clear that birth means birth as we understand it, not some other metaphysical understanding of birth. So that's what the Buddha meant by birth. Yes. Yeah. It's more like in summary. I call it in summary instead of in brief.
Okay, but there's different kinds of
suffering. We say the thing is, once you have the five khandhas, then you have birth, old age, and death.
So, like in summary, like basically, it's five khandhas.
Five khandhas, yeah, that's the problem. When you've got five khandhas, that's called life.
Yeah.
And that means you have the birth, the old age, and suffering. And you'd always have some lamentation, pain, grief, and despair. No matter who you are, you'll always be sorrow. You always have lamentation, pain, grief and despair, or suffering. Not to get what one desires. Today, what did I have? I had to do with some chips today, but they were lost in my bowl. Because people gave me all this other food today. I had to put it on in the top of my bowl. So what I saw was cake when I started eating my bowl. I did actually dig around to try and find something in the bottom there. But, you know, I put the chips in first of all, and so they were totally sort of beyond my reach. So that, I did actually. I put three Yorkshire puddings in there, but I could only found two of them. That was true. And so this is what I say, not to get what one desires is suffering. And birthdays are suffering.
Okay, but just in summary part of it. So, but the five Canada suffering more because they're essentially suffering,
yeah.
Not just because of that.
That's right. The point is that they can say, well, you know, birth is suffering, I've been there, that's got that over the way. And old age is suffering, but maybe I can avoid that by sort of having euthanasia when I'm sort of still fit. And death is suffering, I can anaesthetize myself. So, you know, as Woody Allen said, I'm not afraid of death, I just don't want to be there when it happens. So, you know, that sort of stuff, you can maybe get away with that. So, lamentation, pain, grief and despair. Maybe you can get some, so get a good therapist to get rid of that stuff. So, not to get what one desires, okay, maybe I can become rich and powerful. But when it says the five khandhas, there's no way out of that. So all the other ones, you know, people say, well, yeah, I can get out of it this way, get out of it that way. But the five khandhas, that you're stuck with those. So that's why that's... five candidates, this is real suffering, okay.
So the wording, because this is when they make a word, so basically they can say, so basically the five candidates.
Yeah, basically it's a good word, yeah, okay. Basically, yeah.
How does one reconcile that statement of the fact that the age of the suffering with the fact that the number of parts in the past of energy is happiness?
Yeah, that's the best you can get. There's some jhanas and lots of joy and happiness, but still they suck. So still, the choice between sort of nibbana, everything ceasing, and having more jhanas in your next life, it's no contest.
For an ordinary person, isn't it important not to create a black hole before you can start?
No, shouldn't create a black hole, the better. But when you know that they're suffering, they're a problem, they're the pain, then you know that when you do get difficulties in your meditation, you do get obstacles in your life, things don't go the way you want, it's not your fault. It's not anyone else's fault. So you don't go getting angry and upset at other people when life goes wrong. But straight away you know that this life is like this. But you know that you don't have to keep on having a life like this forever and ever. The round of rebirths can be stopped. So your whole aim does not become trying to make this life a happy, peaceful, wonderful one. The whole aim gets make this the last one, not a good one. So the whole aim changes when you understand this. For most people, they want to just make this life by, let's say, learning a bit of meditation, getting wise, getting some good strategies, becoming more powerful or more clever to lessen their suffering in life. But the Buddhists, that's not their aim. Their aim is to make this their last life. Yeah?
Without the suffering, you couldn't, I don't think you can start practicing.
Yes, it shows you just something to do. Again, going too deep. But remember, this is the whole Eightfold Path. So So this is only not here yet. So when you get to the Eightfold Path, you understand what the problem is, and this is the solution. Oh yeah, because extremism, the annihilation gets sort of into negativity. That doesn't get you out. No, Daniel was next. Yeah.
That's important, right?
It's important. Indeed. Because again, this is one of the things which people don't want to see.
So we only talk about this to other people. With the Buddha from the start, he said, it's suffering.
Yeah, no, it's one of the great sayings of the Buddha is you don't teach morality to people who are immoral. You don't go and teach the five precepts to the bhikkhus. You don't go around teaching meditation to people who are really restless. You don't teach wisdom to people who are stupid. Yeah. So you've got to be very careful there. So you start with just like the Buddha used to teach, teaching about heavens, teaching about sort of the beautiful rebirth you can have when you're making merits and goodness and kindness. And then he used to say, when the listeners' minds are malleable, then he teaches them the teachings of the Buddha, of all the Buddhas, the Four Noble Truths. So, you know, you work people up before you usually tell people life is suffering. But, you know, you guys have been worked on for a long time now, so that's why I don't mind teaching you direct.
In answer to Nicholas' question,
yeah.
I think there is happiness, is what you said. Happiness is knowing that there's no happiness. Joy and laughter, there's no happiness.
That's right, that's really good.
So that is the happiness, actually. Once you know that there is suffering, and that this is the way out.
Indeed, I agree with you there. So anyway, birth. Now what about old age? They call it decay here. But it's old age, as we see. The old age of beings belonging to this or that order of beings. They're becoming aged, frail, grey and wrinkled. The failing of their vital force, the wearing out of their senses, is extended to the broken teeth, the blotched skin. So I think there's a lot of people. When Amandus was here for the race, I'd always point out Amandus at this point, because he actually looked old. But there's plenty of old people here. This is called old age. In other words, it really means old age. What is death? The departing and vanishing of beings out of this or that order of beings. Their destruction, disappearance, death. The completion of their life period. Dissolution of the groups of existence. Discarding of the body. This is called death. So the Buddha wasn't talking about some, again, metaphysical death. It was like real death. What is sorrow? The sorrow arising through this or that loss or misfortune which one encounters. The worrying oneself, the state of being alarmed, inward sorrow, inward woe. That's called sorrow. Lamentation, whatsoever through this or that loss or misfortune which befalls one, is wail and lament, lamenting and wailing, the state of woe and lamentation. This is called lamentation, just crying rise out when it gets very bad. And what is pain? The bodily pain and unpleasantness, the painful and unpleasant feeling produced by bodily impressions is called pain. And what is grief here? Now this is not the usual form of grief, it's just a bad translation because there's no other word. The mental pain and unpleasantness, the painful and unpleasant feeling produced by mental impression, this is called grief. So this has got the physical pain we just talked about, this is the mental pain. And Buddha makes a lot about the difference between the physical and the mental pain. And what is despair? Distress and despair arising through this or that loss or misfortune which one encounters. Distressfulness and desperation, this is called despair. So these are like almost like examples of suffering. But it makes the two main ones, so what is called pain and grief, the physical pain and the mental pain. They sort of manage to get all of them together. Yeah? Anything which comes as an object of the mind. Mental objects. And what is the suffering of not getting what one desires? And here the Buddha says there's an example. This is just one possibility of not getting what one desires. To being subject to birth, there comes a desire, oh, that we were not subject to birth. Oh, that no new birth was before us. Subject to decay, disease, death, sorrow, lamentation, pain, grief, and despair. The desire comes to them, oh, that we were not subject to these things. Oh, that these things were not before us. But this cannot be got by mere desiring. And not to get what one desires is suffering. The Buddha was just pointing out something else there that's very often I've come across, like people actually come up to me, Buddhists, and they say, oh, I don't like being reborn. I'm not going to get reborn again. You can't just do it by desiring. In other words, they're going to suffer when they get reborn again. So just by desiring, you can't end life. You can't end samsara. You can't end it by desiring. By aspiring, by striving, by craving. This rage retreat, I'm going to really do it. I'm going to get my jhanas again. I'm going to get some enlightenment, this rage retreat. All the situations are just perfect for me. I've got a quiet place. I've got a healthy body. I've got 2.5 more months in front of me. I'm going to go for it this time. You cannot get this by desiring. Okay? Now the mere thing is actually added in there. The word isn't just mere there. You can't get it through desiring, okay? So stop all this desiring, all this wanting business. Now we come to the five khandhas, or groups of existence. Now what are, in brief, are the five groups of existence? They are corporality, body, feeling, perceptions, mental formations, and consciousness. So, we actually see what they are here. All corporal phenomena, or rupa, past, present, or future, one's own or external, gross or subtle, lofty or low, far or near, all belong to the group of corporality, of body. All feelings, again, past, present or future, one's own or external, gross or subtle, lofty or low, far or near. All perceptions, whether past, present or future, one's own or external, gross or subtle, lofty or low, far or near. All mental formations belong to the group of formations, sankharas, whether past, present or future, one's own or external, gross or subtle, lofty or low, far or near. All consciousness, whether past, present or future, which must include original consciousness, one's own or external, gross or subtle, lofty or low, far or near, all belong to the group of consciousness. Now that's actually, we chanted that in the Anattalakkhana Sutta. Now that's a great thing to stop there and focus. It means this is all of these things, okay? There's no sort of consciousness activity outside the consciousness khandha. The consciousness group. You can't have like a cosmic consciousness, or an original consciousness, or a ground of all being consciousness. All of them the Buddha's putting into this khandha of consciousness. So the Buddha's very clever there to make sure that when you actually see what the Buddha said, you couldn't really find out any type of consciousness or any type of feeling of pleasure outside of these five khandhas. This was actually including everything. Now, whenever you see in this book here what's in italics, this is either from the commentary or Venerable Nyaya Taloka's own explanation, or it sometimes can be from the Abhidhamma. So, even though these things which are in italics sometimes I disagree with, but at least, you know, respect Venerable Nyaya Taloka, because he actually said what's actually the word of the Buddha and what he's added. So we actually know what's original, what's been added here. So when you read through this, if you don't agree with the italics, fine. That's not the word of the Buddha. That's Venerable Nyaya Taloka trying to help the reader. But anyway, I'll read them out anyway. These groups are a fivefold classification in which the Buddha has summed up all the physical and mental phenomena of existence, and particularly those which appear to the ignorant man as his ego or personality. Hence, birth, decay, death, etc. also included these five groups, which actually comprise the whole world. That's fair enough. So I agree with that. So, you know, it's saying that, exactly what I said, this comprises the whole of existence, the whole of being. Now, yeah?
What is the, in those 11 groups, it says lofty or low, human and panita.
Okay, yeah.
What is it?
It could be like subtle. Like panita is subtle. An example of subtle consciousness is jhanas, because in the Potapada Sutra he calls it subtle but real. He uses the word panita. It's really fine.
So the low, it's not a class, it's not a type of person?
No, no, no. This is a type of like consciousness. So here the Buddha is using these words just to try and make sure that it includes everything. You know, not just gross consciousness, but the finest type of consciousness. Cosmic consciousness, for example. Because sometimes people think that when you merge with cosmic consciousness, that's the real, that's the Brahman, that's the Atman, that's the Nibbana. Merging with the ocean, just like a drop of water merges with the ocean. The Buddha said, no, no, there's the ocean, a drop of water, it's all the same, it's just consciousness. Lofty or low, far or near.
So the five groups,
yeah,
have these 11 categories.
Yeah.
Will include anything we could conceive.
Indeed, yeah. Anything which will be conscious, percipient, which can feel pleasure or pain. Which can feel anything. So what now? Because look, if these five khandhas cease without remainder, that's parinibbana, then there's no consciousness left. So there's no possibility of knowing anything. There's no happiness, no suffering, no in-between even. That's all gone, otherwise there'd be feeling there. There's actually nothing left.
Relief.
Yeah, relief. But sometimes people, the reason why the Buddha said this, and the reason why I stressed it here, because a lot of times people are actually trying to worm and wiggle and spin to try and find something there where you can exist and have a bit of fun. You just can't do it. The Buddha would sort of stop all of those avenues. You blocked all the exits. Yes?
Did the Buddha ever say anything about how all this started? Like how people get into the cycle of rebirth?
There's only one very, very small sutta which even mentions part of that, but he said, look, that's just a total waste of time. Okay, that's just speculation. The simile which he gave was the one of about someone sort of being shot with the arrow. And he said, just, you find out, where did this arrow come from? Who shot it? Who's his mum and dad? Where was he born? Was he sort of Australian? And he said, that's a really stupid thing to do. You've got a real big problem here. But you know, he did answer it just in the end. It's almost like an evolution of consciousness. You know, from even just plant life up to human beings. But that's not made much of. It's only just the one or two tiny sutras. So you've evolved. You've evolved from, I don't know whether it's a weed or a flower or whatever you started off as. Yeah, certainly. I mean, sometimes, of all the realms, got five khandhas. What are the four khandha realms? Arupa, yeah, Hyder realms. What about, now this is a tough question. There is a realm called the one khandha realm. Who knows the one khandha realm? To see your knowledge of the realms of rebirth. One khandha realm. Sorry?
Bodhiyami.
Yeah, but what is that? What's it usually called in Pali word? Yeah. What's it based on? It's called the Asanyasattas. It's the non-percipient beings. It's based on the fourth jhana. Yeah, it's just so still. The mind actually stops. And you stay there, but you've got a subtle body, a mind-made body, for many eons. But there's no mental properties there at all. It's weird, but that's the one kind of elf.
And what happens? Is that elf on the plane extinguishes?
No, no, they just you fall from that realm. The mind starts up again. Yeah. Okay. So, now what are the group of corporeality? The rupa kanda is basically the body. What now is the group of corporeality? It is the four elements and corporeality derived from them. Now this is how they understood body in the time of the Buddha. And when I first came across this teaching of four elements, having been a physicist before, I rebelled. Because this is not what things are made of. You know, maybe talk about quarks or elementary particles, and, you know, sort of the basic forces of nature, and then I'll be with you. But just, come on, sort of earth, air, fire and water. I mean, that's a long time ago. But I got my head around this by saying this is actually how things appear. And no, far enough. Their appearances are like this. So what are the four primary elements? Are the solid, fluid, heating and vibrating element. Okay, so I'm not taking this as like a physical reality, because this is totally wrong. Heat and vibration are the same, because all heat is just the moving of the molecules. So it's vibration. Heat and vibration are one of the same things, but that doesn't matter. It's just how they actually are felt. And there's not much explanation. Actually, there is some explanation here, but first of all, we go to the commentaries here. And this is what's in italics. The four elements, properly called earth, water, fire and wind, are to be understood as the elementary qualities of matter. The qualities, actually how they appear, rather than what they are. They are named in Pali, blah blah blah, and may be rendered as inertia, cohesion, radiation and vibration. All four are present in every material object, though in varying degrees of strength. In other words, the earth element predominates, the material element is called solid, etc. The corporeality derived from the four primary elements consists, according to the Abhidharma, of the following 24 material phenomena and qualities. And again, you get a bit stupid here when you... I'm going to say this. The Abhidharma is not the teaching of the Buddha. And you can actually add extra things in here. You can take things away, because look what they've got here. Eye, ear, nose, tongue, body, visible form, sound, odour, taste, masculinity, femininity. From that, you can see straight away they missed out one there. Sort of gay, lesbian, transgender identity. Vitality, physical basis of mind, hadiyawata, which means the heart base. Gesture, speech, space, decay, change, and nutriment. So all these, some monks who are not made better things to do, try and figure out sort of, you know, what was missing and how they could add something and how they could take something away. So I wouldn't place too much problem on that. Bodily impressions are not specially mentioned among the 24, as they are identical with the solid, the heating. I'll forget about that. Now, what's next is actually quite interesting, because this is actually putting these qualities, the four elements, sort of in their proper place as just a way of looking at your body. So instead of actually being theoretical, this is coming back to earth now. What now is a solid element? The solid element may be one's own or it may be external. In other words, someone else's solid element. What is one's own solid element? Whatever in one's own personal body there exists of karmically acquired hardness, firmness, such as hairs of the head, hairs of the body, nails, teeth, skin, flesh, sinews, bones, marrow, kidneys, heart, liver, diaphragm, spleen, lungs, stomach, bowels, mesentery, which is the content of your stomach, excrement, and so on. This is called one's own solid element. Now, whether it be one's own solid element or someone else's solid element, it's just called solid element. They are both merely the solid elements. In other words, you're just looking at those parts of the body which are solid, there's just solidness. And one should understand, according to reality and true wisdom, this does not belong to me, this I might not, this is not my ego. Okay, now those of you who know a little bit about anatomy, what's missing out from those? Can you see anything which is missing out from those? The brain is a big one. You know why? Because that was actually included under marrow. because it's, you know, it's in the middle of the bones of the head. Anything else missing? Sinuses? You asked Nita about those. There's so many things. So this is not sort of perfect. It's just a description. You can extend it if you wish. What now is the fluid element? The fluid element may be one's own and may be external. What is one's own fluid element? Whatever in one's own personal body there exists of carbonic required liquidity or fluidity, such as bile, phlegm, pus, blood, sweat, fat, tears, skin grease, saliva, snot, oil of the joints, urine, and so on. This is called one's own fluid element. Now, whether it be one's own fluid element or whether it be the external fluid element, they are both merely the fluid element. And one should understand, according to reality and true wisdom, this does not belong to me, this is not my ego. So they're trying to get the whole body with its solid and liquid stuff to say that this is what the body is. So it's not Ruby, it's not Richard, it's not Nicholas. It's just your solid and liquid element, that's all it is.
So the important thing is not the classification so much as that last little paragraph after each one.
That's
this does not belong to me, this is not, and this is not myself.
Indeed. So in other words, this is just body. So especially, but not just your body, other people's bodies as well. So you guys, especially you young guys, you see a beautiful lady coming in here, all this is hair of the head, hair of the body, nails, teeth, skin, bile, phlegm, pus, blood, sweat, fat, tears, skin, grease, saliva, snot, all of the joints, urine. And that's all what makes up a supermodel. So, or a hunky guy, or whatever else. So you don't get attached to these things. So if you actually just imagine what's inside that gorgeous hunk of a guy who walks into the monastery, then straight away, that, you know, well, maybe I'm glad I'm a monk, or I'm a nun or whatever, I just don't want to get involved in all these things. Yeah?
I'm just wondering, how do you keep a healthy balance between meditating sexually and not being sort of like too caught up in the human body?
Yeah. Well, if it's really sort of, you see it, it's, these are just things, you have to have some saliva, otherwise you don't sort of digest your food. You know, all these things are useful for you. But you look at these things and you don't get into the fact that this is something they're not. We're not saying these things are disgusting, some of it is. But, you know, this is just the nature of a body, this is what a body is. So it's not a person, it's just a body. Yeah?
Why do you say ego instead of self?
Ah, that's just what they put here, self is fine. They're just their translation here.
I think that the fact that knowledge of like oneself, it has to be like a real experience, a model form, because I think the people who have a form of it, this can feed into a very kind of wall within the culture.
Indeed. I think what the need needs to do is actually just to use this. Again, it doesn't belong to me, not himself, not my ego, just to analyze, to get to the first sort of doubt with the way that we've been taught since we were young that this is me. Look in the mirror in the morning and you say, this is Nicholas. You know, that it was Ajahn Brahm's birthday today. It wasn't Ajahn Brahm's birthday, it was just a birthday of my solid element, my fluid element, my heat element, and vibrating windy element. So it's their birthday today, not Ajahn Brahm. So in other words, you don't sort of get too upset about sort of the body. You don't sort of, you understand what it truly is. Indeed, because we always had mentioned earlier that the true Dharma leads to peace, leads to freedom, not more suffering. But what is it?
Isn't it also like balancing?
The balance, yeah. Because that's right, yeah. So it's because that's very true. Because people always look at their body as something wonderful and beautiful, and they spend a lot of money trying to make it more beautiful and more lovely. That is why that this does balance it. The heating element. The heating element may be one's own, it may be external. What is one's own heating element? Whatever in one's own person or body exists of karmic required heat or hotness, such as that whereby one is heated, consumed, scorched, whereby what that which has been eaten, drunk, chewed, or tasted is fully digested, and so on. This is called one's heating element. Now that's ancient Indian medicine. They say that if you've got too hot a digestion or too cold a digestion, your food doesn't get properly digested. So it's an interesting way of looking at it, just like the energy by which your food gets digested. And by which one is not just heated up by consumed, in other words, that this is what consumes your body, which eventually wears it out, too much heat. Which is probably why people always say that, you know, if you put something in a fridge, it lasts a long time, because it's not consumed. So people living in cold climates should live much longer. Is that true?
Chinese also have the same thing with the heat.
Yeah, that's right, yeah. So anyway, this is internal heating element. Now, whether it be one's own heat element or other heat elements, they're both merely the heating element. And one should understand in quantum reality and true wisdom, this doesn't belong to me, some not, this is not myself. What is a vibrating windy element? The vibrating element may be one's own, it may be external. And what is one's own vibrating element? When one, in one's own personal body, there exists a karmically acquired wind or windiness, such as the upward going and downward going winds. Almost like this is like the chi, like the energy growing in your body, which in Indian medicine was again the winds. And an interesting anecdote, some years ago, I read this in one of these Buddhist magazines. The Dalai Lama visiting sort of New York or somewhere, and he had his personal physician with him, and they decided to check out his personal physician, and they took him to one of these wards, and they didn't tell him what ward it was, and they gave him one of these patients to diagnose. And so, you know, I think he felt the pulse, and he said there's a blockage of the winds in the heart region. The guy had a coronary, but it's amazing just that the doctor, you know, he got it right, he just explained it in different words. You know, the winds are sort of blocked over here. So it's funny, it's interesting that it did actually work. So there's upwards and going down winds, the winds of the stomach and intestines, and we all know what those are. The wind permeating all the limbs, that's the aches and pains, in breathing and out breathing and so on. This is called one's own vibrating windy element. Now, whether it be one's own vibrating element or whether it be the external vibrating element, they are both merely the vibrating element. And one should understand in quantum reality and true wisdom, this does not belong to me, this am I not, this is not myself. Just as one calls hut the circumscribed space which comes to be by means of wood and rushes, reeds and clay, even so we call body the circumcised space that comes to be by means of bones and sinews, flesh and skin. So this is just one way of many of trying to look at this first candor, your body, to understand what it truly is. And to understand it's just suffering, that's all. It's a pain, because it never does what you want it to do. Now we go to the second candor, the faith in the candor. There are three kinds of feeling. Pleasant, unpleasant, neither pleasant nor unpleasant. Finished. Now what that means... The word feeling is not the best translation of Vedana. And the reason is because this was a word which has no parallel in English. Because this is the quality of every experience, every sensual experience of pleasure, pain or somewhere in between. And in English we give every such Vedana a different name for each sense. So here it's, you know, for every sense, a common name. So, whatever is pleasant through the eyes, we call beautiful. Whatever is painful for the eyes, we call ugly. And we have just in between, neither painful nor pleasant. If it's through the ear, through hearing, what is a pleasurable sense of hearing? Mm-hmm. Melodious, sonorous, or whatever else is. Whatever is a pleasant sound. What is an example of the unpleasant? Cacophonous, discordant, whatever, grating. chainsaw, whatever, karaoke. But that's an unpleasant. And then you've got sort of smell. So you've got like fragrance is a pleasant smell. And unpleasant is stinky or whatever, I don't know. It's all sorts of different words. And through taste, delicious and say bitter and just in between. And of course, through the body is where we mostly find our words of pleasure and pain from. And then we have mental, the mental pleasure and the mental pain. The joy, the inspiration, the bliss, the ecstasy, and the mental suffering, the despair, so the psychosis, the anger, the ill will. These are all examples of mental pain. So the Buddha was saying with these six senses of seeing, hearing, smelling, tasting, touching, and mental objects, in each of those six forms of consciousness, those six senses, there is always the pleasure, the pain, and the in-between. And that's all it is. Just the experience of pleasure and pain in each of those six senses. That's called Vedana.
I think the in-between means it's not felt at all.
No, it's not that it's not felt, but it doesn't register as pleasure, delightful, beautiful, whatever. It doesn't register as painful. So it's neither one nor the other. And that's actually a lot of times it's like that. You know, we can sometimes call it boring. It's just, you know, it's just there. It's just, like, look at a brick. It's not beautiful. It's not sort of ugly. It's just a brick, that's all.
If you are aware of something, you're going to have one or the other.
Now this is the other thing, that one of the things which I've said, which is very true, that all the pleasurable feelings for every one of the six senses, it's just a pause between two painful feelings. And without the pain which went before, it wouldn't be pleasurable now. And it's the same with all pain, it's just a gap between two pleasurable feelings. I think one of the times that really came to mind was when I was reading this book, I forget what his name was, but he was one of these poor journalists who was captured, imprisoned by the Argentine junta during that time, and he was tortured. And, you know, because he had friends in the United States who asked questions about the junta, and the junta in Argentina, the military dictatorship, was getting a lot of support from the United States, he actually survived. They eventually set him free. And he wrote a book about his experiences. He was one of the survivors. And one of the anecdotes was that he told his wife, because, you know, he knew he was likely, possible, he would get sort of taken away in the middle of the night. He told his wife, if I do disappear, please, whatever you do, don't write to me. And that was his command. But, of course, she did write to him. And his torturers gave him the letter. And he said that was the worst torture of all. Because what it did, he'd been underground in these cells, being tortured on his electronic machines and other stuff for a long time. And basically, you sort of get used to it. You've got nothing to compare it with. But when he got that letter from his wife, you know, his whole former happiness came into perspective. And that made so the torture machine so much more painful to bear. He had something to compare it with. And that's actually why the torturers gave him that letter.
More torture.
More torture. That was the worst thing they could possibly have done. Yes. Of course, yeah, even in heaven. Even if in heaven, you know, if the sort of tea, you know, it's not got quite the right amount of sort of condensed milk in it. That's torture. But, you know, when I was in Thailand, to get any cup of tea was heaven. It's just, again, it's just comparison. What it's saying here is pain and pleasure is just relative comparison. You can't have this pleasure without the pain beforehand. That's actually a nice thing to remember, because if you're ever having a painful experience, especially physical pain, you know it can't go on forever. You have to have some pleasure soon. That's just the nature of it. And if you have any pleasure, you can't have eternal happiness.
And it's just a question of perception. I mean, some people like the pain because of a different perception.
Yeah, but then again, if they like the pain and there's no pain there, then they're in big trouble. There's no pain. Give me some pain. No, that's pain. Yeah.
There's a word for English in Vedana itself. Because when I was doing my studies in psychology a few years ago, aspects, you know, the positive and the negative aspects.
Yeah, okay, yeah. But I think...
So like you want to rate, like, oh, is it on the positive side?
Yeah,
exactly. And they call it affect,
yeah. Yeah.
It's a
I mean, it's a specific, specific word just for. It's not not in common usage.
No.
Yeah.
I'm getting a sense that in one's life, the proportion of positive experiences to positive experiences and negative experiences kind of balances.
Usually, in the human realm, they balance. Yeah.
But say between the amount of positive negative versus the neutral experiences, if you become more disenchanted of this passion about life, does that reduce the amount of pain and pleasure?
No, actually, it usually increases the pleasure and lessens the pain. Because you have this whole, like, different levels of existence, and the hell realms is more pain and less pleasure. That's why it's called the hell realms. They still have some pleasure down there. That's why that if you ever read, you know, people have been in torture places or in Auschwitz and Belsen. They had times of great joy and pleasure. They're cracking jokes together and laughing, which is amazing. So, you know, they knew they would like to get gas for the next day. And there they were sort of laughing. And even in the worst places of torture and death, you know, there is some happiness. Which is crazy. First people thought it was crazy, but you can understand now that even in hell there's a few jokes going around every now and again, some happiness. If it wasn't a happiness, then of course, you know, wouldn't notice the pain. And the human realm is supposed to be, you know, 50-50. And you go to the heaven realms and there's more happiness and less pain. And the jhana realms is almost only happiness, but it doesn't last. So in each one of those states, there's always, know, more of one, less of the other. But as you meditate, as you let go more, you're going more towards the heavenly realms, more happiness and less pain. Yeah.
Two questions. It seems private because the in between one is a little confusing, and I think it's in the commentary to the Satipatthana. They talk about a deer running and someone tracking the deer, and then they go over a rock, and then on the other side, and he can't find any tracks on the rock, but he infers.
Oh, yeah.
What does that mean?
I think that's a particular type of neither pleasure nor pain, of, you know, this equanimity of Michael, especially the fourth jhana, Sanyasata.
But in inference, it's not...
Inference, yeah. Yeah, but that's just one particular type of neither pleasure nor pain, of the non-percipient state in based on the fourth jhana. I think that's what it's supposed to be meaning, because there's nothing really felt there. You can't notice it.
And the other thing seems that all this kind of stuff is either going towards something or going away from something. Like pleasure is going towards something, and pain is going away from something. You're either going towards it and going away. It's all suffering.
Yeah, but this is actually just the way we react to it. But just the noticing that those two things or three things exist with all sensory experience is a very important realization. Because it means straight away that the idea of like an eternal heaven where you can be happy ever after, is impossible. It's a myth. So you can know for yourself, you can't believe in that. Which means wherever you get reborn, in whatever realm, whatever state of existence, you're always going to get a bit of suffering. And that makes the whole thing just a total waste of time.
So it also seems that in this realm there's much more suffering than there is pleasure. You have to really work to get some pleasure. You don't have to work to get a house dirty, have to brush your teeth, to have to go to the bathroom. You don't have to work to that. But to get some pleasure, you have to do something.
Oh, it's pretty simple these days. Turn on the TV. There's how many channels? 40, 50 channels, 60 channels? Yeah. Sorry?
Imagine being a bird. They're just hungry all the time.
Yeah. And fighting their reflection in glass and upsetting Danny all the time. So some of those animals. The worst thing about animals you see in the jungles, they're always afraid. They can never stay still for a moment because there's always other animals about to eat them. And see the animals in Australia, they're pretty happy because they don't have many predators. But in the jungles, you see them, they're totally psychotic. So that's actually the Vedana. It's a very important part of the Kanda. It's why it's suffering, because you can never have any peace there. The happiness is always changing. But there's some satisfaction there, the suffering won't last. Yeah?
What do you mean by psychotic?
Psychotic means that they have no peace, that basically paranoid for good reason. I just noticed they can never be still. They can never sort of rest and just say, you know, look at the sunset or just enjoy things. Because all those animals, there's always some other animal about to eat them. Remember the squirrels? Just the way they move, they're always fast. They would never stay still for a moment because they're always on the lookout for their predators. And all these other animals, always living in fear. So it's the psychosis of almost constant fear. Okay, the group of perception. Similarly, very quick. What is perception? There are six classes of perception. Perceptions of form, sounds, odors, taste, body impressions and mental objects. Again, it's from the six senses. And what the perception is, it's explained elsewhere, is it's just basically categorizing things, again, comparing things, you know, white, yellow, red, green, male, female, sort of big, small. So it's the way we actually add specific qualities to our sense perceptions. And most of those perceptions have been conditioned into us, mostly by our language. And when we were at school, we taught language, and language is usually the means of perception to most of us. And so a lot of that perception which we're taught, which we believe in and makes our world, is quite arbitrary. There was that story, and it's believable, that when Columbus's ships first went on to, it was Dominican Republic, I think, where they first landed in the Americas. They say the indigenous population there, even though the ships were right in front of them, they couldn't see the ships. That's what they say, because they couldn't perceive it. That very idea of like ships, you know, was just not part of their language, not part of their perception apparatus, so they just literally could not see it. And to me that actually is quite believable. Because we are limited in our perception by what we think can exist, by what we're taught exists, and it's so conditioned, and there's of course been so many psychology experiments done around perception, which are usually very, very funny. I remember one of those experiments was where they, I think it was in Harvard, they had some pictures of around the campus, and they got the psychology students to be in a little theatre, and they flash an image of a well-known place on campus quickly on the screen. And of course they had to note it down what they thought it was, and it was just too quick to form a proper image to find out what it was. And then they increased the exposure incrementally, so they had like more exposure, they should have more information about what that scene was, and they kept on increasing. What they found out is that, you know, we took a guess, and one example was they thought it was like a ship at sea. And they increased the exposure. Yeah, it was a ship at sea. That's how they saw it. And yeah, it was a ship at sea. And it was actually the stairs to, I think, the chemistry building in Harvard. And they had an exposure there which, you know, any human being would see it was the stairs of the chemistry building in Harvard, the chemistry faculty. But these guys would still see it as a ship. It just showed just how perception actually works. And they said the hardest image to get right, which took the longest exposure, was a couple of dogs copulating. Because it was not a pleasant thing, according to the way they were brought up, to see that. So they kept on being in denial of what they were seeing, until it was just up there so long they had to admit it. So a lot of our perception is very arbitrary, we're so conditioned the way we perceive. And that's one of the joys of meditation, which I will mention to you. And as you get deeper and deeper in meditation, all that conditioning of your perception can get removed and start to see things in weird ways. That's when, like the Ajahn Chah experience, when he experienced his body exploding and a liver on this tree and a heart on another tree. This is just what happens. Or he's looking at the wall and the wall turns like it starts to melt and all the bricks drip down like chocolate on a hot day. Or just you feel your body just expanding, just filling up the whole room. You get weird perceptions. And it's not an acid trip. All it is that all these conditions which you place on your perceptual apparatus gets removed. And you start to see how sort of what perception is basically what we add to reality. I think what keeps us the same experience is because everyone else agrees with you. So it's like agreed perceptions. The peace and the stillness help, but it's also getting the sort of some teaching, some guys like me. You say, yeah, we've been there, done that. You know, it melts, but it'll be solid again afterwards. It's just the mind is playing around, so enjoy it. And when you understand it's just playing around, it's a temporary sort of thing the mind does in a certain stage of meditation, you can enjoy it, you're not afraid anymore. You don't know what's going on. Oh, that's just when body starts disappearing and just before nimittas. That's where it usually happens. It's fun. Enjoy it. It's weird. So you've actually started to understand what perception actually is. Remember that we live mostly in a world of perception. It's how we perceive Buddhism, Christianity, how you perceive the guy or the girl sitting next to you, how you perceive mushy peas, which we had this morning. Remember Ajahn Yana, we used to have a great joke with him because mushy peas was one of the things I was brought up on. It's only that because that's why I like it. It's only by conditioning. It's not inherently delicious. But poor Ajahn Yana, when he was here, his parents would always give him these mushy peas and force it on him, and he hated that. So for these today, you know, if he sees mushy peas, the perception is this is disgusting because it's a symbol of his dominant mother. So all those perceptions, that's all they are.
Well, it will be able to see things by practicing this practice because we're more open to that.
That's another thing, yeah. But by doing this practice, you can also be able to see UFOs. Do they exist? There's perception, that's all. So, now we're getting, obviously, we started just with the body, the five khandhas, the groups of existence. These are actually, there's a lot of overlap, as you'll probably imagine, between, say, even the previous one, feelings, pleasure and pain, and perceptions. Because, you know, just sometimes you might say pleasure and pain is one particular type of perception, which again is, you know, conditioned. You know, one particular type of music is happy. I remember the first time I took a pint of British beer, because, you know, you had to, about 13 at the time, you know, just it was a big thing for a guy to do, to take your first glass of beer. And it was disgusting. And I really couldn't believe that after going through all this like fear and bravado and, you know, worried about what if I get caught and sacrificing so much, and it was disgusting. And I just couldn't understand just why just people would spend so much money and having all these shops all over the place, all these pubs on every street corner selling this ridiculous concoction. But of course, the place where I was brought up everyone else was saying that beer was delicious, beer was fun. It only took me about 3 or 4 months, and it was delicious. I forced myself, because of peer pressure, to regard it as delicious. And I remember another one of my friends, because this was in the late 60s when people were trying to get into all sorts of drugs. And the rumour, for those of you old enough to remember this, the rumour was that if you got banana skin and put it in aluminium foil and kept it for a couple of days, it would actually turn into sort of a substance similar to LSD. And so, of course, one of my friends did this. And he took it. He said, wow, it really is true. Wow, it's amazing. I had this amazing trip. And of course, it was a scam. It was just, you know, one of these myths which was going around just to sort of trick people. But, you know, because he thought it was true, because of peer pressure and being the first one to do it, you know, he made himself sort of have those perceptions. Yeah. That's right. So this is actually what happens with those perceptions. So there's a lot of sort of overlap between perception and feeling. So these five khandhas, they're not sort of categories which are actually separate. There's a lot of overlap between them, each one of them. But what the Buddha's trying to do is trying to cover all aspects of both the body and the mind. And taking out these particular aspects like feeling and perception, because they're really important in understanding just how we work. The group of mental formations, now listen to this. What now are mental formations? There are 6 classes of volitions, will, chetana. Will, connected, I've said it directed, connected to forms, sounds, odors, tastes, body impressions, and to mental objects. They can see there that the Buddha's talking about mental formation of sankhara as will. Now, he does that very often. And everybody knows that sankhara, this fourth khandha, is much bigger than will. But will is the central feature of it. And of course, from my teachings, you understand why. Because the last place where the self hangs out is either this khandha, will, or in consciousness, doing and knowing. So the Buddha wanted to actually raise this will. Look, will, it's not you, not me, not mine, not a self. It's just a khandha. It's suffering. And as he was saying, this is suffering. And that's incredibly revolutionary. To say your will is dukkha. Not a cause of dukkha, but it is dukkha. And after a while you realize that, because when you try and do something, when you have a will, that's a tension inside of you. You're not at peace. Or it's that simile which I said, every time you want something more, you can't enjoy what you already have. When you want something, when you're willing to get something, you can't be at peace. So will is actually the big problem. And this is actually where it says this is the main, biggest part of sankhara. However, he said, the group of mental formations is a collective term for numerous functions or aspects of mental activity which in addition to feeling perception are present in a single moment of consciousness. In the Abhidharma, 50 mental formations are distinguished, 7 of which are factors of the mind. Blah, 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 forget about that. However, right down the bottom it says, in the Discourse on Right Understanding, there are 3 main representatives of the group of mental formations are mentioned, volition, sense impression, and attention. Of these again, it is volition, which is being a principal formative group, is particular characteristics of the group of formations. And therefore serves to exemplify it in this passage given above. But will is really important. And that's the main part of these mental formations.
Is the reason for that because that's the teaching, or is it because,
It is because it underlines many of the other mental formations, like thinking. Is one of the great mental formations. But where does that come from? One wills and then one thinks. So you may actually say that just the heart of the sankhara is chetana.
Because in the Pali, each of those senses and chetana at the end.
Yeah.
So he makes it very clear.
Yes, indeed. And the group of consciousness, the last one, I don't do the first paragraph here, we call it at night. What now is consciousness? There are six classes of consciousness of form, sounds, odors, taste, body impressions, and mental objects. In other words, these are totally different types of consciousnesses. It's not just consciousness in a different form. They are totally separate, different experiences. As I mentioned in my little book, Mindfulness, Bliss and Beyond, the reason why we think that they're the same, or there's something similar to seeing and hearing, to smelling, tasting and physical touch, is because after every one of those external conscious moments, it's usually followed by mind consciousness. I see, and then I know I saw. I hear, and then I know I hear. Otherwise, the consciousness doesn't really register. So that similarity between all those five forms of consciousness comes about because one knows after one sees, hears, tastes. And that is what gives it a commonness. But these are just six completely separate entities, the six classes of consciousness. And especially the last of those forms of consciousness, mind consciousness, that is what we call the knowing. So you see that to sum up the five khandhas, we have body, we have pleasure and pain, perception, will, and knowing. That gives you a good idea of what you are, or what you take yourself to be. And that's in particular why the Buddha mentioned those five forms. Many people take the body to be themselves. Many people think they own their pleasure and pain, which is why they work so hard to get more pleasure and less pain. Many people just believe their perceptions are being true, which is why they argue with each other. And then many people cherish their will. And they think that just strengthen your will and make it wiser, then you become enlightened. Not realizing the will in of itself essentially is the problem. It's not me, not mine, not myself. You can't do anything with it. And lastly, the knowing. We think that's the seat of the soul. That I am the one who knows. And here the Buddha saying, no way. Five khandhas. He's saying they are suffering. Now that's a powerful point. Yeah, God. It's a knower who knew. Because this is actually when you add that sort of the time element to that self-consciousness, you know something, and then you know that you knew. If you look at it that way, it solves so many problems there. That type of mindfulness is called reflective mindfulness. So there's a thought in the mind, you know you had that thought. And you know that you knew that thought. So you don't know that you know. You know that you knew. And that makes it much clearer. And I was saying that it's not said here, but it's in another place. But it's already implied here. That every one of these khandhas is suffering. Far refined or gross, far or near. So, all body is suffering. The having to have pleasure and pain is suffering. Perceiving is suffering. Will is suffering. Consciousness is suffering. Now that's a very hard thing for people to understand. Because we think that to know is to enjoy life.
And I suppose that's why the jhanas are so important, because the khandhas drop away one by one.
And you see for sure, yeah. In the jhanas, you have direct experience that when these khandhas disappear, you're blissing out. And the reason you're blissing out is because many of those khandhas have gone. Again, in the deeper jhanas, second and above, will has disappeared. And you don't realize what happiness is. until that will is gone. And I always call will like the prison guard. You can imagine just in some of these tough prisons, not like Australia, but we've got this sadistic prison guard. I remember just one of the prisoners here, he said he would meditate every morning. And when the prison guard saw him meditating, he'd sort of rattle, the flashlight. He'd bang the flashlight on the door, he'd rattle it against the grill, he'd put the flashlight right in the guy's face to try and disturb him from his meditation, because he didn't want the prisoner to feel any sort of peace or happiness. And so imagine like a prison guard like that. You're asleep and they wake you up. You're eating and you enjoy the food and they make it sort of undelicious for you. Always sort of making you do things. You sit down, you've got to get up and do some work. You do it work this way, you've got to do it another way. Now you may have a head anagarika like that, but I don't think this type of thing is okay. But imagine you had like this bossy, sort of always complaining, always negative, sort of head anagarika, always telling you what to do and how to do it, and never sort of giving you a moment's rest. That's called will. It's not yours. It's actually pushing and pulling you around, telling you what to do. And we get sucked into it and thinking, that's me. That's why we can't let go. That's why all the meditation is about letting go. Yeah.
So, I always thought that the will came from your thoughts, but the will is what's actually putting the thoughts in your head, right?
It's a circle, whichever way you start the circle. So, see, the will sort of creates the thoughts, which reinforces the will. So, but the way to stop that is to stop the will. Shut up. And then your thoughts stop. You try and stop your thoughts and they don't stop. Try and stop the will, you can do that.
How do you do that?
Let go. Let it be.
Just watch thoughts come up and don't react to them?
Don't react to anything. Just thoughts. Not my business. Nothing to do with me. Just thoughts. Just do whatever they want. No control. Let go. What you're letting go of is letting go of your will. You're not letting go of the thoughts. You're not letting go of pain. You're letting go of will. Controlling, manipulating, doing things.
So all the five standards, if you would summarize in terms of the Buddha, you would say this does not belong to me.
Yeah.
I am not, and this is not myself.
That's right, yeah. Yeah. So, nothing to do with you. They're not me. They're not yours. Not my thoughts. Not me, not mine, not the self. If they were my fault, my thoughts, I actually would be able to do something with them. Sorry, get your head around that tonight. Sorry? Get your head around that tonight. Yeah. But don't try. That's more will. You're getting caught up in him. Okay, so we'll finish there for tonight. And next we get the dependent origination of consciousness. And we get more about the three characteristics of existence. And straight away into anatta, which is really good stuff. So, what we did today was just the start. I must admit, I never get really inspired by the four elements, but I tried my best. So if you got not inspired, it was probably because of the way I taught it. But the rest of the stuff really gets interesting.